Hello and welcome to the Aldi podcast with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Aldi, and I'm delighted to be interviewing Craig Brown, the funniest man alive, about his latest fantastic book, A Voyage Around the Queen, which uses this extraordinary technique, which I think you've invented, which you used in 1, 2, 3, 4, The Beatles in Time, and Ma'am Darling, 99 Glimpses of Princess Margaret, of building up a huge amount of views by other people. How do you define it?
Yes, well, some people say it's a sort of mosaic, and I suppose it is, or a kind of jigsaw. So lots of little chapters, not necessarily chronological, and all shedding some sort of light from a funny angle on the central object. I mean, I suppose it is an innovation, but it was originally the product of necessity, the necessity being the product of my butterfly mind. And so I'm very much a journalist, I think. I thrive on sort of 1,500 words, 2,000 words. And so that accounts for the little chapters. So I know I can write them in a day. And so I sort of tried to make a benefit out of this deficiency.
But you had to do a huge amount of assimilation, didn't you? Because I understand you went through the London Library, practically every book about the 20th and 21st century, and went through the indexes looking for mentions of the Queen.
I could do that in a relatively short time. It's only about 10 days, I suppose. Just piles and piles of these books. And then the great thing is now, and it's only happened in the last 5 years, it used to be you'd have to photocopy all these things, which would take an amazing amount of time. But I didn't have a mobile phone, but I bought one just for the camera. So you can just take photographs, and then you can copy them later. So I had sheets and sheets and sheets of these meetings, because most people who met the Queen want to, if they're writing a memoir or a diary, they want to put it in, they want to sort of boast. I mean, obviously most of those meetings were dull, but I'd say 1 in 15 gave me something.
And part of the magic of the book is the extraordinary effect the Queen has on people, and quite often they can remember what they say, but they can't remember what the Queen said, is that right?
Yeah, I think, and that's a product of people being very self-conscious when they met the Queen, so that they're terrified of doing something wrong, so they're only thinking about themselves. But it's also the product of the being this protocol. The Queen asked the questions and you gave the answers, but you couldn't ask the Queen questions. And so conversations were always lopsided, and it meant that the Queen virtually said nothing. So she'd say, "Very interesting," or that kind of thing, to encourage. And also, you know, I have some sympathy with the Queen, because most of her conversations had to be over in 30 seconds or 45 seconds. So there was only time for her to ask a question, how far have you come, or something like that. Person to reply, "I've come from Chelmsford, it's 3/4 of an hour. And she'd say, "Very interesting," then she'd move on. So there wasn't that. I mean, obviously with the more famous people, like the people who'd written the memoirs and the diaries, they tend to be not just queuing in a crowd, you know, to watch her waving. They've gone to the palace either for lunch or to get an honour. And so the conversations are rather longer. But equally often, or in a way more often, people just talk gibberish at her. They didn't know. Terry Wogan described it as the royal effect of just people being so sort of tense that they just talk nonsense or go far too deeply into a subject which they know she couldn't possibly be interested in.
Which, in fact, you did yourself when you met her.
Yes, yes. I was only in my defence, I was a student and I was doing drama and I was slightly drunk, as many people are when they meet the Queen or met the Queen. Yes, and the host said, "Oh, I wasn't expecting to meet her," and he said, "He's a friend of mine's father," and he said, "Oh, Craig's studying drama," and she said, "Very interesting," and of course I stupidly thought that showed she was really interested, and I was telling her about Bertolt Brecht and his theory of alienation, and she kept taking steps backwards to try and release herself, and I kept taking steps forward to kind of give her further knowledge of Bertolt Brecht. Anyway, as Terry Wogan said to Phil Collins after Phil Collins had started whistling a song in a sort of mad way at the Queen, he said, it's the royal effect. People just talk nonsense at her, do idiotic things, and they regret it for the rest of their days.
And as a result, there's also a fascinating effect of, for all her magic and the rest of it, a great relief when she leaves the room.
Yes, yes. Joyce Grenfell's mother, Laura Langhorne, said when royalty leaves the room, it's like getting a seed out of your tooth, which is rather harsh on them. But yeah, there are reports. A friend of mine, Nikki Shulman, had a report of everyone, a group of grandees meeting at the National Gallery. And as the Queen came into the room, people were, you know, these sort of great captains of industries, millionaires and things, art experts, were rushing out of the room because they just couldn't sort of face the tension and embarrassment of meeting the Queen. And a lot of, Hilary Mantel gave a good description like that, of just people running away at her approach. Because it's necessarily awkward, and also in... the reports by sort of comedians and singers having to perform before the royal family and the Queen at the Royal Variety shows and that sort of thing, of what a deadener they were on an audience. None of their fault, because they were just being themselves, but every audience would then be watching two shows. They'd be watching the show on stage, but they'd also always, before laughing, they'd check that the Queen was laughing before giving themselves permission to laugh. And because of that, the comedians or the singers would turn in bad performances because they were also very nervous. It's all very interesting, I think.
And you say in the book, I believe this, that it's because not only of her constitutional position, but because no one in the world is like her in how present she is in our minds. You know, the Beatles have been famous for 60 years, but only since the age of 20.
Yes.
Anyone born since 1920, who would have been sentient when she was born in 1926, have been brought up every aspect of her life. You say that you know more about Prince Andrew's life than about your own siblings.
Yes, and almost more than I do about my own life, you know, because I couldn't tell you what... Well, yes, I couldn't tell you where I was eating the night that Prince Andrew could remember that he was eating pizza in Woking. Yes, and obviously one knows about their school days, you know, about... And I couldn't tell you my names of my brother's early girlfriends, but with Prince Andrew, you know about Kustark and all those, Katie Rabet, and you can look them up. It is extraordinary. And with the Queen, you could find out what she was doing on virtually every day of her life. And for someone to be, as we were saying, she was famous from the moment she was born for the next 96 years. And I think no one's been that famous for such a long period of time in human history. And even the Beatles, first they were 19 or 20 when they became famous. But then their fame kind of dwindled. I mean, Paul McCartney is obviously still very famous, but I think Ringo Starr could probably walk along the street and not be recognised now. You couldn't say the same of the Queen.
Do you think it's fading? There's a brilliant episode starring your very clever son, Silas, so when you ask him the names of the children, what does he say, the Queen's children?
This was when Silas was about 15, I suppose. I think I might have been doing the Princess Margaret book. I was just interested in how much the younger generation know about the royal family, and I said to Silas, could you name the Queen's children? And he said, well, there's Charles, yeah, and then there's daughter, Anne. And I said, yeah. And he said, oh, and then the one married to Fergie, Andrew. And I said, yeah, well done. So what's the last one? And he gave a long pause, and then he said, Steve? But, I mean, I find that kind of reassuring that actually they're not so sort of craven to all these junior royals. You know, because why should I know the name of, you know, Princess Michael of Kent or her children, or
because we have been brought up with them.
And
then your book is brilliant because you never get an impression of you either oiling up to the Queen or being rude about her. At times you say she's strangely prescient about things, and at times she comes across as very dull. What do you think she was actually like?
Well, I think the kind of almost the principal theme of the book is that she was what everyone wanted her to be. She was a kind of blank canvas. I mean, that's slightly to do with her keeping herself to herself and not seeking fame and never giving an interview or anything like that. But people, and I got an email from a friend of mine whose family were close to the Queen, so they'd known her all their lives. And this person said, your book got her exactly, her sly bossiness. I thought, well, that's, I know, it's a good kind of, it's a good little expression, but I hadn't been trying to say that in the book. But in the same way that people could see whatever they wanted to see in the Queen, they could also see what they want to see in the book. I mean, I suppose the you could say in the 700 pages, however long it is, there might be examples of what you could call sly bossiness, but it wouldn't have struck me as sort of the overriding impression I was trying to give of the Queen.
And she has this extraordinary effect on commentators. You spot so many unusual things about this, just the kind of sociological effect on people, this brilliant thing of the way all commentators start speaking backwards. Can you explain that?
Yeah, well, it's most striking if you hear recordings of Richard Dimbleby. So they won't say the Queen came into the room wearing her crown. They'd say the crown being worn by the Queen. It doesn't come naturally to me. The door having opened, the Queen came in.
Up the aisle, yeah. Caparisoned beautifully, yeah, yeah. Named the coffin of the princess.
It is. It's very funny, and people are still doing. They were doing it at King Charles's coronation, and I suppose it's this sort of bogus antique feel, which the royal family, and the Queen herself did institute various traditions which were completely invented. I mean, and are now dropped, like the investiture of the Prince of Wales. Well, that was a ceremony. I think Edward VIII had done it, but no other Prince of Wales did it. And they invented, and Lord Snowden invented this sort of camp investiture. And I don't think there's any suggestion that Prince William, though he is Prince of Wales, is going to have an investiture. So they can invent these traditions and then drop them. And so I suppose that's like people inventing this language to talk to them about, which is sort of sounds grand and sort of suitably pompous.
And Walter Annenberg, the former American ambassador to Britain, doesn't they start using a lot of pompous Latinate words?
Yes. I think, yes, people in her presence, and they probably would still do it with Charles, though I'd guess not with William, because that's a different generation. Yes, so they won't talk about the house, they'll talk about their accommodation, all that. The sort of long words. I think people were so worried about, because the Queen stood for doing the right thing and being respectable, and I have quite a lot of in the book about people's dreams about her, and they're always about doing the unrespectable thing in front of her, so being either completely naked or badly dressed or spreading mud over the floor or that kind of thing.
Or the brilliant Kingsley Amis, one of the more confident people of the last 100 years, remind listeners what he said.
Yeah, well, Kingsley Amis, who is one of the most robust people, when he went to see the Queen in Buckingham Palace, or before he went, he took a course of Imodium, so because he was so worried about farting or evacuating his bowels. And then Martin said that after he took so much that there was some worry he'd never go to the toilet again in his life. And he went on this strictly, what he called a strictly no beans and onions diet. But even Alexander, the kind of great revered, your predecessor as editor of the Oldie.
Alexander Chancellor, yeah.
When he was going to one of her, she had these regular lunches for about a dozen kind of grandees. And before he was led in, a courtier advised them all to spend a penny. And Alexander said, "Oh, I don't think there's any need." And he said, "Well, I would advise it. So some people have had accidents in the past." It is extraordinary. Yeah.
And Greg, were you a monarchist before writing the book, and were you one after?
I'm actually a person of few opinions, or I have them, but then I change them. There were times when I was writing the book when I became rather entranced by Willie Hamilton, the almost the only Labour MP. He was moderate in other ways, but who actually came out anti-monarchist and became rather rabidly anti-monarchist in a way that even someone like Jeremy Corbyn, you know, they have to pretend to be monarchist. And Corbyn obviously wasn't, or he would never mouth a word against the Queen. And so sometimes when I was writing the book, I got so sort of fed up with the sort of flummery of it all that I did become anti-monarchist. And then, you know, and the little instance in the Queen's life where you think, well, she put a foot wrong there. But I, at the moment, if you ask me this morning, I'd say that I start the book with a quote about from John Updike, where he, can I well read it? This is the great, to my mind, American novelist. And he said, "Without their crowns and coronets, how could the English be distinguished from Icelanders?" And I think there's a lot of truth in that. It is our sort of USP as a nation. Also, I've slightly come round. I suppose if I was completely honest, I'd say I am marginally in favour of the monarchy for the same reason that Richard Crossman, who was started out as a Republican MP, he was sort of going around the same time as Wilson, Harold Wilson, and he was an intellectual Wickhamist. He started out as a Republican and got really fed up with it, having to be, you know, all these MPs having to be spend an hour on being taught how to sort of shuffle backwards and to genuflect at the right time to be initiated as Privy Councillors. But in the end, after sort of 10 years, he thought, well, actually, it's the illogicality and irrationality of the monarchy, which is its raison d'etre, that he thought human beings were irrational and they needed an irrational outlet. And that obviously if you corral societies into a rational society, then you become like, you know, Mao's China or Stalin's Russia, you know, extreme rationality has to be resisted somehow. And I can see that. I can also see, especially when Donald Trump was president, you do think, God, it's clever to have a monarch who's the head of state and to separate these two roles.
And also, having once thought that it'd be great to be one of the royal family, actually you end up feeling quite sorry for them. There's a brilliant bit where poor old King Charles, quite recently, didn't know what a tea bag was.
Yes, and then there are always those reports that he gets someone else to put his toothpaste on his toothbrush, like that old aristocrat from the 19th century. I can't remember who once, when he didn't have his butler travelling with him, screamed from the top of the stairs, "My toothbrush isn't frothing." He had no idea that you had to put. And so there is especially with Charles, who I think is more precious than his mother or father, he has that. I mean, the Queen, Max Hastings, in his memoirs, said he was talking to a courtier, this must have been about 15 years ago, as a journalist, and the courtier said to him, "What you chaps don't understand is she really enjoys her job." And so I think she did, and that was one of the reasons she kept active at it. And of course she'd been destined to it from the age of whatever she was, about 10, when Edward VIII abdicated. And so she'd got used to the job, but you know, it was a really interesting job and really kept her going, and she went everywhere and met people. And obviously it was sort of hard work in a way, but in other ways it was an extremely good life. I think it's more difficult actually for the ones I tend to poke fun at, the sort of juniors, the ones who aren't the king and the sort of fourth child, or and then they get caught up in the celebrity world. I have a chapter in the book which is about the descent into celebrity, and you know, and Prince Edward, as he then was, doing It's a Royal Knockout, and
brilliant,
and that sort of thing. But you sort of think, well, they don't really have a kind of role, and then they start, unlike the Queen, they start thinking that everyone loves them for themselves, and their particular talents. Of course, they don't. They're just famous. People don't either love or hate them.
And there's a good point made by our friend Ian Wilson, saying they are very, very, very different. And when they try to be normal, they can't really. So Prince Harry trying to be matey and laddish, but there's a good bit on him and Meghan complaining about Nottingham Cottage. Well, I've seen the outside of Nottingham Cottage. It's an extremely nice, very pretty cottage by Kensington Palace. Yeah. And they start complaining about how small it is.
No, we'd be very happy in it. But I suppose if you're brought up in Kensington Palace and then you get married, then you know, I think it is only sort of 2 or 3 bedroom. I'd love to live there. I'd be very happy. But Crawfee, the governess who was then sort of ostracised by the royal family, the Queen and Princess Margaret's sort of governess, she had lived there. It had been her grace and favour house. So in royal terms, it was a sort of servant's cottage. So everything is sort of relative. But it is, I mean, it is a very, very odd life. And I think one of the sort of conundrums of the Queen is that she was such a sort of normal and, well, actually, A.M. Wilson described her as uninteresting person. But, I mean, it's amazing to carry on being boring or uninteresting, if you want to call it that, in such an extreme...
Yeah, amazing not to go mad.
It would send most people mad. Obviously sent Edward VIII mad. I mean, in a Princess Margaret, actually, was once being... Gore Vidal complained to her that he found the Queen heavy going, and she said, yes, but that's what her job is. You know, she was there to be heavy going, yeah.
Craig, you're good at mocking the royal experts, but haven't you de facto become one? Haven't you?
Yeah, there's a real danger. And even now, as I'm talking to you, I feel a sort of boredom descending on me. And people at literary festivals and, you know, people say, well, what would the Queen think of, you know, such and such things which happen? Of course you don't know. Or what did the Queen think of Prince Harry? Or what did she think of Meghan Markle? And it's that area which is the danger of being, you know, you think of yourself as a royal expert. I mean, I obviously know more about... Actually, I probably don't know much more about the Queen than is contained in the book. You know,
there's a lot there. Yeah.
I mean, I got rid of, say, 40,000 words, but that was mainly about other people's views on her. And so, yeah, if I did another royal book, I might ask you to shoot me.
But, Greg, there's a very funny bit where you attempt to buy a bit of royal wedding cake at auction.
Yeah, there was an auction.
That's with irony, presumably, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah. But in earnest, I mean, yes, there's an auction house near us. I live in Suffolk, in Essex, in Colchester. Auction house called Riemann Dancy, who has an annual royal auction, which actually I noticed this year, you know, you can get, I mean, quite good value things, like, shows that I'm still tempted, but, you know, a signed Christmas card from Philip and Elizabeth, it's sort of 60 quid, good, you know, and you could put that on your shelf and no one would know it wasn't directed to you, you know, sort of quite a good bargain when, you know, a meal of a pizza and a glass of wine now costs about 60 quid. So anyway, yeah, so I thought they had one of the top things, it's about 3 years ago, was the Queen's first driving license, or only driving license, when she was, during the war, she'd joined up in the army and learned to drive a car. And I thought, well, that would be appealing. And I can't remember what it was, about £2,500 estimate. But of course, these things go for far more. That did. And so that went for 8,000 or 9,000 or 15,000, I can't remember. And so then when you're at an auction, you then get also thirst to what they call win, which of course isn't, it's just losing. You lose all your money in a way that no one else is prepared to lose that quantity. And so I looked further down, you know, and lot 314 or something was a piece of Princess Anne's wedding cake, her wedding 1973 or 4. To Mark Phillips, you know, one of the dullest weddings of, yes, of that century.
Therefore much funnier, yeah, if you had got,
yes, them. And so and it came in a little box, you know, and you know, with a little certificate and everything like that. And I do regret not getting it. So I bid up to about £60 and it went for 65. So then you think, oh God, I could have got it for 70. And it, but you know, you can go mad like that. And I, you know, I'd love to be able to now produce it for you, and I mean, we could nibble on it or something.
Greg Moore, generally, you originally went to acting school, is that right? You wanted to be
it's doing drama.
Doing drama, sorry.
At Bristol, so it wasn't. I mean, some people then went, I mean, a great friend of mine went on to be an actor, but I wanted to write plays. And there are only 10 people in each year who just doing drama. Some did drama in French or drama in English. And I think I was the only one who wanted to be a writer, but others wanted to be directors or, yeah. And it was a reasonably academic course. So, you know, so you learned Ibsen or, you know, or Brecht, like I was telling the Queen.
So when was the moment when you realised you're extremely good at writing funnily?
I was doing sort of funny writing. I mean, actually, you know, if you look back on it, even my prep school magazine, I've got one where I'm doing a parody of Harold Wilson in number 10. So I was probably 9 or 10 there. And then when I was at public school, I was doing sort of parodies of Pinter. And so I haven't made much progress. So got almost 60 years, you know, of doing roughly the same thing. But I, in the mid-70s, when I went to university, playwrights seemed the sort of sexiest thing to be. I mean, everyone knew about Pinter or Stoppard. Or, and slightly the spotlight's now gone elsewhere, I think. And so that seemed to be a good thing to do. I am meant to be turning the Princess Margaret book into a play at the moment, but
you writing it,
yeah,
right. But is that very difficult, is it?
I'm not, because I'm sort of doing talks about the book about the Queen. That's, it's slightly derailed it. I think it's I'm looking for a sort of structure. It's got to have some kind of structure. I think I'm good at dialogue, and often with my parodies, there's dialogue. You know, I'll parody a TV show, or you know, Downton Abbey or something like that, or I've just done Loose Women, the TV show. So I think I can do sort of snappy dialogue, but it's just getting the structure right.
And aware of what our great friend Barry Cryer said, analysing comedy is like dissecting a frog. No one laughs and the frog dies. But at the same time, it is interesting. Where do you think your gift came from? Were your parents very funny?
I mean, actually, Barry was really good at dissecting comedy, and so and actually the frog never did die, but I think comedies, even the simplest knock knock joke or something like that, is really worth analysing. You know, what makes it funny, and they're usually very compact jokes, especially that kind of knock knock, and the precision is really interesting. I don't know what I think there's an element of, I've got a feeling that not all comedy, because obviously lots of very good working class comedians, or the majority are working class, but I think a certain strain of English comedy comes from being sent away to prep school, boarding school, and having to kind of create this slightly defensive... first, you have to create a kind of imaginary world, but also it's defensive. And I think comedy can be a sort of defence against emotions and that kind of thing. And
an extension of the idea of taking on the school bully.
Yes. Well, and I remember a lot with a great friend of mine, Charlie Miller, who went to work at the BBC as a director. But we would... I think Charlie had a tape recorder... and we'd spend a lot of time, this is when we were 10 or 11, imitating the teachers, or especially the ones we were frightened of, I think, the more ludicrous or grotesque ones, into the tape recorder. And I think it was a way, it was a kind of form of voodoo, you know, you create this doll and you can kind of stick pins in it. And so I think, but, you know, it's also just a way of having fun. I mean, so you can over-analyze, I suppose, or make it over-gloomy. I mean, you know, we laughed a lot doing it.
Yes, knowing it's very enjoyable. That's why it's extraordinary, isn't it, when you quite often meet very clever people who are completely humourless. It's quite strange that you thought they would at least learn the rules of what
yes,
they're saying.
I think that shows that they're not very clever. I mean, I'm not saying that every... I'm not saying that Alexander Solzhenitsyn has to sort of tell, you know, crack a joke, or, but I think completely humourless people who are so sort of solemn, and you get it in academia a lot and academic books. I think that actually you can't be really clever without having
no,
some
it's like
kind
they're
of
missing
sense.
A missing a limb.
Yes, because it's a way of distinguishing between things and being able to joke about it and seeing irony, and it's all about seeing that there's one world and another going on at the same time and all that sort of thing.
And observing things, which you're brilliant at. Like
it's the opposite of pedantry in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, and being able to spot patterns, like with that extraordinary thing I'd never noticed, but it's so true of Royal Comet is talking backwards and seeing how
ridiculous
it is.
Yeah, and I suppose that's a kind of comic impulse to notice. I mean, I'm also interested in just the way people use language, which is, especially in my private life parodies, it's the kind of clue. I think that language is the clue to character. So as long as you follow the sort of the trail of the language, you'll get to the character.
And I think I've read when you do your parodies, what you will read what people say or write and then get into their character.
Yes. I mean, then there's the thing... it's not just copying, because that would just be copying. So it's not kind of forgery. You then have to add a sort of 10% grotesquerie to it to make it absurd. Yeah. So you have to add the absurdity. I mean, some of the parodies I do which don't work are ones which sort of reproduce the person, but there's no actual joke to it.
Right. Yeah.
Or the joke is weak. Yeah.
And what do you think it is in someone like the great Barry Humphreys, we both knew, who sadly died last year? I thought he was working on a sort of higher level altogether. Do you think there is a sort of Olympian level? I'm not trying to have
I mean, certainly Barry, when he was being Edna Everage, it was completely... I think it's true also of Steve Coogan when he does Alan Partridge. There's a sort of seamlessness. You could never... see any sort of gap in Edna Everage or in Alan Partridge where you think, oh, that's the actor, that's the, you know. And that's, yeah, so I think those two are geniuses in those roles. I really regret, actually, I'd started doing the Queen book before Barry died, and I kept meaning to sort of ring him up to talk about the Queen, because he had quite a lot of meetings with her, and of course... Dame Edna, in a way, was a parody of the Queen.
Yes,
it was
sort
of the Queen in someone's nightmare.
Well, you do lots of jokes saying, I've been talking to a very close friend. I can't say she is, but she's a significant woman who lives in the Windsor area.
Yes. Or that he pretended in one of them that he had his own room at Buckingham Palace. And he said, you know, the top right-hand corner, you can see my toothbrush and things like that if you look really hard. And Yeah, so and I wish I'd... so stupid of me, anyway. But, you know, you never expect anyone to die. And it's great sadness that he did.
And a particular strain of British humour, I'd say Private Eye is at the heart of it, which is sort of Richard Ingram's handing it on to Ian Hislop. Mm. There are bits of it in The Spectator. The late, brilliant Aubrey Waugh had it. How do you describe it, that sort of ironic, witty, rude, fearless humour?
Yes, and it has to be slightly, which I think I'm maybe a bit too careful, but you have to be prepared to go too far, you know, to just take it to one level of vulgarity. I mean, humour, you know, people who aren't humorous, they always say, oh, schoolboy humour. They don't just say humour, they say schoolboy humour. As if there's sort of humour which is so sophisticated that they would only they would understand the joke. But of course, all humour is schoolboy humour because it kind of reduces people, you know, to sort of cartoon characters in a way. I mean, so I think the great thing, with Bromore especially, was he would go too far and people would say, oh, that just is good, you know. And even I, as a great fan of his, I thought, oh my god, that's going too far, you know. But that's your job. As a satirist, which he was.
Nick Garland, who did the brilliant cartoons for Barry McKenzie and Barry Humphries, said Barry Humphries was happiest when he had people on the verge of being very, very upset.
Yes, and also, I remember I used to go to all his sort of West End shows, actually with my my parents at the beginning. But there was one, and I think it's on one of the records. He's saying something outrageous, and then everyone is laughing. And he says, now I know how Adolf Hitler felt. You know, you can control an audience, and they're laughing outrageously at something they shouldn't really be laughing at. And and so he realised that sort of weird power of, especially of live comedy. Yeah.
But I'll finish on a perfect comic situation is that there was a terrible story this week that it looked like Ian Hislop had been shot at in a taxi in Dean Street. It turns, and the back window of the cab got smashed in, and you know, it would have been terrible. Turns out that I think it was a fault with the car, but immediately brilliant jokes started forming. Paul Merton had done it, or possibly Richard Ingram has wanted his job back.
That's funny, yeah. Yes, I remember, it was only a couple of days ago, but there was something immediately about the story. I thought, well, actually, if you were going, I mean, you know, there was a Charlie Hebdo awful story, you know, 7 years ago, or however long it was. So where the satirical magazine, the editorial team were all shot and killed. And Private Eye then had it, you know, they were advised by Special Branch, or whoever does it, to have a reinforced door, which they do, as far as I know. And so there is always that danger. But I thought it was most unlikely that you'd wait for someone to be in a taxi before. Anyway, there was something which didn't sound right, so I didn't really spend too much time worrying about it.
And in fact, actually, Private Eye were very brave when Princess Diana was tragically killed, of immediately, and the issue came out very soon afterwards, pointing out the Linda Lee Potters of this world who had been attacking her days before.
Yeah, they're very good at hypocrisy. I mean, they're more satirical. I see myself more as a humorist, but I'm Private Eye more satirical, so they're, you know, they're slightly more aggressive. Yeah, but they did show that Linda Lee Potter, 3 days, who was the sort of Glenda Slag of her day, was saying she's a terrible mother going off on holiday like this, leaving her children. What's she doing, sort of gallivanting around with, you know, Dodie and everything? And the minute she died, there's never been such a marvellous mother. But that's journalism, yeah.
Well, Craig, that's a very good place to stop. A lovely interview about your brilliant book, A Voyage Around the Queen. Thank you so much to Craig Brown for appearing on the Oldie podcast.
Thank you.